free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen, and we have a very special guest on our Free Energy Now show today, July 30th, 2007. Chris Patton is both a good friend and a producer in Hollywood and a mover and shaker behind the scenes largely in the new energy movement. He has been around the block a few times on, you know, traveling around, looking at different technologies, filming different technologies, and he's preparing a film that's going to be coming out in the major motion theaters about some new energy technologies. We're looking forward to the release of that film. I was able to talk him into coming on the show today to talk about one of the technologies that has his interest quite keenly. He's actually, if I understand right, he's actually involved in helping this technology move forward. He's going to have to be a little careful in what he says because he does have some NDAs involved in the company he's working with on this. But he's going to be talking about a technology that was very promising in the 1930s and was kind of put on the shelf because oil just got too cheap. And it's time to pull that thing off the shelf and really make it rock and roll. So, Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Sterling. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, this, as I mentioned in the introduction, it's really a treat for me to have you on this show. I just really enjoy you as a person.
It's a treat to be on the show. I'm a big fan of your work.
Thank you. Well, the ammonia technology, tell us about that. What is that about?
Well, it's interesting stuff. I'll give you a little bit of how I came across it and how it relates to the film and why I think it's fairly important. A lot of this ammonia research and water absorption or ammonia absorption technology or refrigeration absorption technology was very hot to trot between the 1860s and the 1930s. And you're correct in your assessment. Fuel became very cheap and very accessible. So a lot of these smart thinking technologies tended to die off in the 1920s and 1930s. And I'll just kind of give you an example of how I was exposed to this. The gentleman who trained me up in engineering and solar engineering is a gentleman named Shelby Henderson. He's 87 years old as of last week, a brilliant man who was the co-inventor of the VCR for Ampex back in 1952. And he was also an OSS spy engineer who would he reverse engineer really brilliant German technology and make it better for our spies to go back over to Germany with. So one day, about 10 years ago, he and I were doing some research on the on advanced energy systems, and he just threw this on the table one day about him having this closed-loop ammonia turbine engine for an automobile back in 1939, and he ran it for several months and brought it into the U.S. military in the early 1940s, and it kind of just got shelved immediately because of its not only because of its potential, but because of its potential military application as an emergency storage system, as an emergency power plant. And I said, well, what's the basis of this technology? And he said, well, basically, it's a refrigerator. His father was one of the co-inventors of refrigerator compression and refrigeration compressors in the 1920s, 1910s. And he said he got the idea from a device called the Crosley Icy Ball, which was something that the Crosley Motor Company sold in the 1920s, which was sort of a more of a giveaway than anything else. They sold them with cars, but they also had them as these standalone refrigeration systems. And what you had is these two aluminum balls that were connected by a pipe, and you'd heat one end in the sun, and the other end would extend into your house and turn into a block of ice using the absorption refrigeration technology that we still use today. And heat, you could also put propane underneath one side, and the other end would still turn into a block of ice, and you could flip it around, and it would do the same thing. So it's a fairly well-known chemical reaction, because ammonia boils somewhere around minus 45 degrees Fahrenheit. So anything 10 degrees above that, you get a moving reaction. And if you start pushing it up to 200 degrees, you can get a really fast moving reaction. Well, he took that moving reaction, and he put it into the form of a turbine. So he took a bottle of ammonia, heat expander that was wrapped around a ignition coil that would heat up the expansion chamber. The ammonia and the water would then go into a turbine from a Fiat, I believe, and then go up to a four-stage compressor where it was reliquefied and then brought back down into the container again. So essentially what you have is an engine that will run indefinitely for about 15 years or 5 years, depending on how well you build your system. And as long as you don't leak, you should be in good shape.
And it's a closed-loop system, so you're not having to replenish the ammonia. It just keeps going and going and going.
That's correct. That's correct.
And the input energy is what?
You could say solar. Let's be political correct and say there's no such thing as a closed-loop system that runs itself. You require solar power to keep it going, which is a fancy way of saying anything above ambient room temperature.
Uh-huh.
So if you can come up with an exterior heating source like propane or, let's say, hydrogen. Let's use an economy that everyone wants to move towards today. Let's say you used a little bit of electrolysis with a solar panel, and you were storing up a little bit of hydrogen, and you used that solar to electrolyze water to create hydrogen. Now you have a heating source that you can preheat a pipe. So when the ammonia comes squirting out, you've preheated your chamber. It now goes into the turbine, and you've got motive power. So it's solar.
Well, how much of a gradient do you need to have for this thing to be productive?
Well, not much. As long as you can keep the temperature between 85 and 120 degrees, you'll keep that fluid moving pretty quickly. Now, there's two fields of thought on this, because I've had some protests out in the field where people were saying, well, there's not that much energy and that much gas in that small of an area with that small amount of heat, and they greatly, greatly misestimate the amount of energy potential that is in that much gas when it's expanding that quickly under that small amount of heat, because you are dealing with refrigerant that stays liquid at minus 45 degrees. When you start pushing in heat and start expanding that water, because normally they add a little bit of water in with this ammonia, you get a tremendous amount of expansion energy. And if you build your system correctly, you will get one whopper of an energy output, somewhere on the realm of anywhere on the low side of 25 horse up to an infinite amount of horse, depending on how you build your turbine. And then, of course, where the inefficiencies start to build in is on the compression, which is when you have to re-liquefy this stuff. On a small system like this, you'd need the equivalent of a 4 or 5 horse four-stage compressor. Now, the way he built it at the time is he built it so that the gas coming through was actually running the compressor, so it didn't require an exterior compressor. And an example of that today would be your engine running. Well, if you've got your air conditioner running, it's its own compressor, requires about 4 horsepower to run. He was smart enough back in 1939 to have the air conditioner running itself off its own compression, off its own horsepower.
Huh. Now, I know, just for the sake of those who may not be as familiar with the heat pump technology world, there's a terminology called coefficient of performance, COP,
okay,
that is actually used probably inappropriately in other contexts, and it's actually it originated from the heat pump world, from what I understand, and it has to do with the amount of energy that comes out versus the amount of energy going in. And these heat pumps actually would make us scratch our heads a little bit in that there is more energy coming out than going in. Maybe could you talk about that in a general sense for a minute?
You bet. I'm going to try, because, again, it's such an interesting oddball area of science for me, because it's not that it's unexplainable. It's just that it potentially has that second law of thermodynamic potential of being controversial. Because here's what you've got. You've basically got this energy potential stored in the form of a liquid. And when you add water to it, now you've added, you know, this other extra strange potential of hydrogen being available, or extra energy, extra heat being available when you add a warm flow of air to it. So from the coefficient standpoint, here's what you've got. When you heat up a liquid that is minus 45 degrees Fahrenheit, okay, and now it explodes or expands into a gas, if there's oxygen from water inside that chamber as well, those molecules will expand. And so it gives not the illusion, but it gives you that extra oomph that you'd need to actually get some real work out of the product. Was that simple? This is a tough one for me as well, because this is a fairly new area of science that I'm trying to get my mind around. Even though it's been around since the 1860s, it's fairly well known because everyone's refrigerator runs on it. And the standard cycle that we follow with this coefficient of energy is you have freon that runs through these coils, and inside your refrigerator, it's absorbing. When it turns back into a liquid, it absorbs all the heat out of the environment, and so you get the freezer that you get, and then a little compressor crushes it back down into a liquid and puts it back into a storage container again, and it just keeps that cycle going for as long as your refrigerator doesn't move around and you don't have any freon leaks. So I'm sorry if I'm not very good on answering that question, I'm afraid.
Yeah, we've had other people on the show in the times past, especially Ken Round, who's expert in this question.
Yeah,
he has ambient air technology that he's been trying to get some funding for quite some time. That is really quite ingenious.
Oh, good for him.
But the story on the street, if I understand it right, is that even our refrigerators, the heat pump aspect of the refrigerator is there's more energy coming out than what they're putting in. And the source of that, from what I gather, is the ambient air in the environment. And you're calling that solar.
We call it solar.
Yeah, and that's kind of a cute way to put it. In other words, it's not coming from nowhere. It's not like ex nihilo, you know, just inventing this energy from nothing. It's there. It's just being transferred from one. You didn't put it in the wires in electrical input. So these things run very efficiently from a point of view of I guess the end of the day, how much energy you put in versus how much you would have to if it weren't for this phenomena.
That's correct. I mean, there's only so many ways to explain that the ambient heat is contributing to this gas expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know, a lot of people would try to define it as a perpetual motion type phenomena. But it really isn't. If you consider that you're living on a planet that's getting bombarded every second with millions of watts of electricity and cosmic rays, the energy potential you have for just tapping into ambient energy and putting it into a closed-loop gas cycle should allow it to be a perpetual cycle. And there's nothing that violates the laws, the second law of thermodynamics or physics. It's just being very creative in the mechanics of taking a gas and putting it in a position where it can do work for you in a very small enclosed space by just adding a little bit of cosmic energy to it, or solar energy.
Well, from a net energy point of view, meaning you put X amount in and you get X amount out, one of the questions that I don't have quite clear in my mind, maybe you can help me out with, is, you know, you've got what you're calling solar energy input,
right,
the heat that comes from the sun that makes the air warm, and that's making this ammonia raise in temperature, and then you have a condenser on the back end which condenses it back down into liquid. It would seem to me that you've got the heat on the front end and you need to have basically a cooler on the back end. Wouldn't those equal zero at the end of the day?
You're asking a filmmaker. This is the argument that splits everyone down the middle. When I'm working with guys that are used to working with steam or gas technologies, they realize there's a lot of inherent energy that is lost in a system that's designed badly. So it comes down to really, when you zero things out at the end of the day, you have to zero out the ambient heat that you're adding to the system. Now, if you weren't adding any ambient heat to the system, then you would zero out fairly quickly, and the system would balance itself.
Mm-hmm.
But because we have this X file, this X factor of ambient heat, either in the form of solar, waste heat, or, for example, let's say, for example, you got this up to speed, and the compressor that you're using generates a lot of heat in compressing or pressurizing the liquid back down into its liquid state, or the gas back down to its liquid state. And let's say you shut off your heating coil, or you shut off the solar, and now you wrapped that coil around the compressor and used the waste heat from your own compressor. The idea is that, well, shouldn't it balance itself out? The funny thing is, it doesn't, because that process is actually being used right now by several companies. And there is one company that we actually discovered in looking for these type-like technologies that might be in use today. We stumbled across a company down in Texas that was using this exact process of the using the waste heat from the factory, which is the X factor, which was exhaust heat from a timber company, to run a propane turbine, which was a closed-loop system. So the waste heat from the factory was actually being used to generate power for the factory in a closed-loop propane system. And the reason that they used propane is propane and freon have a liquid freezing temperature difference of about 10 or 15 degrees. So one is like minus 47 degrees. Let's see. Actually, I might even have the numbers for you here. Propane is minus 44 degrees Fahrenheit, turns back into a liquid, or boils, and freon is minus 55 degrees, and ammonia is minus 28 degrees. So they're all within 20 degrees of each other before they begin to boil. And it gives you this interesting variable between these three liquids to use as a potential energy source, because if you've got any waste heat at all, or solar, now you've got a X factor that allows you to keep a potentially perpetual motion system running.
So what you're calling an X factor is basically the energy source.
Right.
You've got the waste heat from a factory. You've got the sun shining on some kind of collector system. Some other source of input heat, which you're calling that your X factor, your input X.
That's the input X. That's what most people would consider to be the thing that unbalances the system, that allows it to continue to flow forward in a perpetual style. Now, just in the last 3 months, there was a project that some students from MIT took on over in Africa, where they'd actually built this exact system that we're talking about with a troughed mirror, which is like a parabolic mirror, but it's a parabolic trough. And they ran a pipe with ammonia, or possibly freon, I didn't get the exact gas that they were running through it, and they were using this system to run a refrigerator and a generator in a small village in West Africa as a student experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you think about that for a second. This is 1870s parabolic mirror technology that the French were screwing with this back in the 1860s. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman in France back in let me look at my little timeline here. Back in around 1882, a gentleman by the name of Frace had a solar steam engine on his roof. It wasn't ammonia, but he had water in it, and he was using a parabolic mirror with a bucket in the center that was full of water, and he would heat the water up, and that would run a steam engine. That ran a printing press in France, and the press was called the Solar Journal, and it was the equivalent of the French Journal of the time or the Paris Times.
Mm-hmm.
So this type of technology is not new. It goes way back, and it was on a real fast-track course for being the standard form of powering cities, homes, and basically advancing technology forward without the use of coal or oil. And that was its original intent, because back in the 1860s, a guy named Augustus Michon got really concerned over in France because the cost of coal coming from England was so high, it would bankrupt the average citizen to keep his home warm. So to save France, to cut off their dependency on foreign coal, he came up with this parabolic mirror to use it to heat water or heat gases so that people could run factories or heat their homes. And by 1881, the French Ministry of Public Works had seen over 900 demonstrations of this technology working. They even gave this guy a medal for his accomplishments. And then they found out shortly after that they didn't need it because they'd reduced the cost of shipping oil shipping coal from England. So the technology faded into obscurity until around 1885. A gentleman in the United States, actually in Pasadena, California, named Charles Tellier, brought this solar collector over. And this is about the time that they started adding ammonias to these waters to find out these interesting things that would happen if you heated ammonia and water really quickly underneath, 1,200 degrees of sunlight. You'd get this massive explosive reaction that you could use to drive generators or drive pumps. And in this case, this gentleman took this parabolic mirror, put it on the roof of his place, and he was using it to use it as a pump to pump his own well at 300 gallons per minute during the daylight hours. So then he took it over. I'm sorry, I'm confusing my timeline here. I get excited when it goes between 1850 and 1905. What was happening is the French and the Americans started working together on these types of technologies. And a gentleman named Aubrey Aubrey Enos was the guy who actually brought it out to Pasadena, California. And they put it on an ostrich farm, and they had this 33-foot-wide parabolic mirror that was sort of a tourist attraction, and it was being used to pump 1,400 gallons per minute of water onto an arid landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was 1900. So between 1860 and 1900, we knew that just using ambient heat technology could provide motive power without the use of a fossil fuel. And that is outstanding.
How does that compare efficiency-wise to, in terms of the price point? I know oil was very cheap, and so I could see why economically at that time pursuing something like this was not economically viable, and you didn't have the environmentalist movement back then as a second motivation to pursue this, and so it was shelved. But now that oil is you know, way a lot more expensive than it was back in the early turn of 1905-ish, 1930-ish, when
yeah.
this stuff was put on the shelf, what kind of price points are we talking about? That, you know, let's say, for example, a coal fire plant, cheapest is about 4 cents per kilowatt hour around
sure.
the planet. What are we looking at for if we were to use this system and, let's say, a home power system?
Oh, boy, it gets kind of scary because you're looking at one-fifth the cost because you're cutting transportation out of the equation and losses.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to be very careful when I say this because you've got four or five different teams that will run these carbon footprint numbers to show you that, you know, the cost of producing the oil or the coal equals, you know, doesn't outweigh the cost of transporting these devices to your home, or, you know, making the metal that makes the parabolic mirror.
Right, and I understand, and that is a good point, but that's not the way most people are thinking in the Western world right now. They're not factoring in that cost, and so to speak their language, to speak the lay person's language that doesn't factor in that cost, you're talking one-fifth the cost for this system compared to what they're getting from the utility.
Easily, because you're looking at one, you're looking at a renewable liquid, ammonia and water, okay? And ammonia is one of the most commonly used chemicals in chemistry worldwide. It's like the second most used chemical. Now, it's hazardous, make no mistake about it, but so is diesel and so is, jet fuel. So you just have to be very cautious when you're dealing with these caustic materials and caustic liquids. But if you're dealing, like, let's say for a cost factor, if you amortize what the cost of building a parabolic mirror or a troughed mirror in, let's use West Africa as the perfect example, and then transport a West Africa model to Texas or the Midwest. As a farmer, the thing that really kills your pocketbook is the cost of maintaining and fueling the farm for water.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one. It really is hurting the American farmer more than most people know. The cost of running diesel generators, or let's say you went back 90 years, a coal power generator, the cost of transporting it, the cost of actually building the plant and keeping those things running is very expensive. The maintenance on those is very expensive. When you look at the cost of keeping a refrigerator going, it tends to run for about 20 to 30 years as long as you keep a sealed system. So as far as maintenance goes, cost of keeping it running goes, cost of materials, and the one-time cost of setting it up, it far outweighs the perpetual cost or the perpetual rising cost of coal or oil prices. And let's add in the cost of retrofitting diesel plants every 5 to 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these expenses really, really, really impact you. So let's take this model to West Africa and say these kids from MIT take this closed-loop ammonia parabolic mirror, and they're right now using it to run a small village as an example of how easily it is to build and transport a technology using off-the-shelf parts and car parts. So we're dealing with less than $1,500 worth of parts to keep a small village in Africa running. Now, transport that model over here to the United States, and let's just say that we could use recycled components, that we had some incentives in place, to build a 1,500-horse or 2,000-horse parabolic mirror, or a closed-loop gas ammonia parabolic mirror system. So for that small amount of money at the one-time expense, for something that could potentially run your farm for 20 years, and you don't have to worry about the war in the Middle East, you're not going to have to worry about the cost of transporting coal and bringing it out on site, the cost savings is incalculable.
Mm-hmm.
It really is, because it's a one-time cost the first time out. You've got to bring a refrigeration technician out there to maintain it once every 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're looking at.
Yeah, that's really amazing. I'm just, you know, a thousand thoughts going through my head here.
I tend to be this way. I know there's a lot of topics that we can cover that are much easier, more streamlined to cover when you're dealing with energy issues. But this one sort of sends me over the top a little bit because it covers solar. It covers so many crises that we currently have worldwide, and it solves so many problems. And we had the technology. We developed the technology. And prior to World War I, we were on a fast track to implementing this technology across the United States. Mm-hmm. Steel and industry and coal took over, and then the production of oil and the movement of oil became a lot less expensive, so it phased out with the production of the automobile. People needed a lot more liquid fuels faster. So the coal industry started to die down, the oil industry built up, and now the need for these, you know, on-site power plants didn't seem as necessary because, oil was readily available and fairly easy to transport now that we had steam locomotives taking everything across the United States. So it's just a combat of economies. It's not that it wasn't as good an idea. It's just that it lost out over a more convenient process and a more economically convenient process.
Well, one of the things that kind of brought this to my attention, you know, I heard you talking about it in our conversations here and there, and this last week in Treehugger, on the 23rd of July, they had a story called Solar Powered Refrigerator in 1935.
yeah, new technology.
Yeah. And it was this ammonia process.
It was. I'm familiar with that article. In 1937, Popular Science actually had some really great films they did that were in Technicolor. And most people don't know this, but they ran a great series for about 10 years on all these innovative technologies that will change the future of mankind. And one of them was with a gentleman named Otto H. Moore, who was a really brilliant inventor that lived out in California. And this guy not only had a solar-powered ammonia run refrigerator, but he also had a water heater, and he also had a this is relating to the refrigerator, but here's what he had. This is how ingenious this was. He didn't have a solar array back then. He didn't have the potential for crystalline technology that we have now for nice expensive solar panels. What he used was a crystal ball, okay, which would track the sun wherever it was in the sky.
All right.
And it would condense down into a beam inside of a bowl. And inside that bowl, he had magnesium and aluminum, or copper and aluminum, wrapped together, which made something called a thermocouple. So you heat up these two different these metals that have these two different energy potentials, and you get electricity. That electricity was used to stimulate a coil, which was wrapped around a tank of ammonia, which cycled through a refrigerator inside of his house. Thus, he had ice. I mean, that's great stuff, man. You couldn't make that stuff up. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, he was using one of the first commercially available water heaters, which is something similar to what you see on rooftops now, where you have four black pipes that have glass over the top and maybe iron on the back side, and it would collect the heat from the sun to superheat your water up to 180 degrees.
So it's forward-looking guy, is back in nearly 70 years ago or so.
Yeah. And I actually did a little bit of research on the cat, and he gave a lecture at MIT on this in 1938.
Mm-hmm.
MIT's known about this. So the funny thing for me, as this motion picture that you've brought up earlier that we're doing right now, here's what the film is essentially about. It's providing solutions that have come and have gone over the last 200 years that either didn't make it because it wasn't economically viable, or it just didn't make it because commercial interest didn't want it to hit the market because it was very offensive or would take coal or gas out of the market, essentially. I mean, let's get right down to it. We're looking at a couple of really strong economic interests that have been running the planet now for over 100 years, and anything that edges out coal and oil is potentially dangerous to those industries. So they tend to come in and buy those technologies or simply use political control to snuff them out or deny patents. So what we've done
Or worse, they use a gun or some other bully weapon.
Sure. I mean, you've got the rumor train that shows that over the last 100 years, people have been threatened by private industry, or private industry has used local government to come in and sit on somebody's chest and threaten them into not taking these technologies out. And it's usually for the sake of the United States or the sake of the economy of the United States. And it's unfortunate because we found out that was also happening in other countries. where it wasn't happening as much, strangely, is Russia. But it was communist, so you'd never heard about it. You simply were building something for the state, no matter how you did it. So we found all these really advanced, amazing technologies that Russia had been developing since the Cold War all the way up through 1994 that were just off the scale incredible as far as material sciences go. And they were also looking into a lot of these ammonia refrigeration technologies, and they had advanced them pretty far. And most of them just never made it to market because they had a communist system, so you never saw them. But they were used in a lot of military applications, and they're really extraordinary. And we're showing a lot of these applications in the film.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to what we were talking about earlier with the, a house that could run on this stuff with the solar input. Is this something that could be feasibly run a vehicle, some kind of a transport, where we're on the fly, where you wouldn't, in the beginning of our show we have this little statement, imagine a vehicle that never has to stop for fuel because the power source is on board and is active as you're driving along. Now, this might not qualify because if you have to have solar input, for example, at nighttime you're out of luck. You'd have to have some kind of a battery system. There are other technologies that we're talking about that would fit that. But let's say the sun's shining and you have other methods of propelling the car along. Would this provide enough energy in itself if you were driving during the day to keep going until the sun goes down?
Yes. This is where I have to tiptoe a bit. I apologize because the motion picture is addressing a lot of these technologies, and I've spent over 11 years financing and developing very comparable technology since I heard about this one in 1996 from my partner Shelby. So a research team that I got involved with in the around 1999, year 2000, actually rebuilt this system exactly from 1939 plans and drove an automobile with it. And we used the heat from the road to actually expand the gas to keep the vehicle moving, and it produced around 25 horse. And this was with an ammonia system.
Is that the heat from the road being because of the cars going on, or because the sun's hitting the asphalt?
It was summer, so what we did is we used solar from the road to actually heat the ammonia. So we put the expander that came. So you've got the bottle of ammonia that then goes into a heat expansion chamber before it hits the turbine and then spins the turbine and gets reliquified. Well, we put the heat expander close to the road, and the ambient heat from that road at the time was about 100 degrees and was allowing the car to propel forward. Now, let's say, for example, we're in Michigan, and it's December, and it's really unlikely that we're going to be having 100 degrees of heat rolling up from that icy, cold road. Well, then you take a coil, a battery, and you wrap that around the expansion chamber, and now you've got the solar heat that you'd require to keep that car going. Now, how efficient that is, I couldn't tell you at this point because the film isn't about efficiency, it's about options. But I can tell you that as of last week's filming, we've seen at least three of those like technologies running vehicles.
Wow.
And it's an absolute possibility. It's been here, it's gone, we've missed it. There's a lot of confusion about how much energy potential is in a closed-loop system like that, except that Nikola Tesla had actually addressed this around 1904 or so, and Dr. Peter Lindemann, in his brilliance and his research, has actually uncovered this as well. Tesla described a motor like this, Tesla's free-acting engine, and he describes it based on watching these closed-loop ammonia cycles with refrigerants of oxygen. He was watching oxygen at the time being liquefied back in the 1890s and thought that was just brilliant that you could turn oxygen into a liquid under pressure. And so he conceived of an idea of using a Tesla turbine with ammonia or a refrigerant gas and using solar or an ambient electrical source to heat the chamber to run this expansive gas through his turbine, run it through a compressor, and bring it back in. So when people are thinking Tesla and free energy, if you look over a lot of what Tesla was talking about between 1896 and 1930, he mentions electricity a lot, but he mentions using ambient energy even more. And he absolutely adored his Tesla turbine, and he adored the idea of using nature, the ambient energy in nature, to propel a motive system. And he really locked in on this one in 1904. I think the lecture was the increase of human I'm sorry, I'm going to screw this one up, but where he's talking about human energy. the increase of using human energy. And if you look it up, you'll find this lecture somewhere on the internet. But he lists out all these technologies, wind, solar, hydroelectric, and the ones that he really liked were this, you know, this perpetual energy system where you take this expanding gas and just keep compressing it back into a liquid, and also wind were his two favorites.
And now, this the story that you sent me this morning from the electrical experimenter that talks about Tesla and solar. I didn't read that carefully, but is that story talking about what you just described?
In a way, yes. It's from my own collection that we're using in the film. It's a 1916 edition of the Electrical Experimenter magazine, and people that are Tesla fans know that he had a really strong relationship with the publisher of that magazine, and he would break stories first in that magazine. And in that particular article, they show in 1916 something really interesting on the first page in there, and it's talking about using solar to power cities. And it's an article that's relating to Tesla's radiant energy antenna and the conversion of radiant energy into usable motive power. And it addresses this one specific system that was in use over in the Middle East. Actually, it was over in Egypt by a guy named the Schumann brothers. And it was a sun heat absorber. And what you had were these...
connection.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you okay?
Somebody just cut out. Was that me or you or both of us?
I think it might have been you or both of us.
Okay.
So here's what you had.
Okay, go ahead.
You had some parabolic mirrors, or these trough mirrors, that were sitting out in Egypt, of all places, and it was running a 100-horse engine, and they were simply piping water through these iron pipes that were sitting in these 200-foot-long parabolic mirrors, and that was running a steam turbine that was getting recondensed. The water was being recondensed back into a liquid and run back through the pipes over and over and over and over. And that was running a 100-horse engine in the middle of Egypt back in 1913.
And that was water?
That was just water.
Mm-hmm. So this is using the same principle, and we can all relate to a steam engine. Is the ammonia engine basically a steam engine but with a lower boiling point?
Essentially, that's all you're at. And if you're looking at steam engine efficiencies versus standard automobile engine efficiencies, it's double. You're looking at around, I believe, 23% efficiencies with the current automobile-designed engine. And with the steam engines, you were in upwards of 50 to 70%, depending on the design. So if you consider how much more energy potential you're getting out of a system like this, because you've got not only lack of moving parts, but it's a direct drive system where you're running steam over something that maybe has 3 to 17 moving parts. You're getting
a
lot more energy.
A variation of this design be to, rather than use solar input, since you know the sun doesn't shine all the time and you need to drive at night and when the clouds are up, you could have a hybrid system where partially it's run by sun, partially from the heat from the road, partially from an external combustion engine on board, where you would have a fuel source, and then you would then fire up the fuel whenever you needed it as the sun goes down or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've got it right on the head. Let's start putting our heads together for a second and think of the amount of losses that you get in a moving vehicle that you could harness into something called usable energy. You've got a moving vehicle, and the one thing we're always trying to do is trying to throw away heat. We're never trying to harness it. In this case, we're trying to reverse that cycle and actually harness it. So let's take the motion or rotary motion of the wheel and try to figure out some way to capture that into it, turn it into heat. Well, friction's pretty good at that. You could take a rubber strap and wrap it around the axle, and as you're driving 40 miles an hour, that rubber strap's going to be getting pretty hot. So you could take like a metal conductive material that could withstand the braking friction and convert that into electricity to run a coil or wrap that around your ammonia expansion chamber to run your vehicle. Or let's take another loss. The wind that's passing by your vehicle could be harnessed inside of a small turbine inside of your grill and converted that into electricity, which could be running a coil wrapped around your ammonia expansion chamber. Let's take the bumpy ride on the shocks and convert that kinetic shock into something like with a piezoelectric system that takes kinetic motion and converts that into electricity. Now you're taking all these losses and converting that into some sort of heat. So now we've discounted the idea of using the sun, and we're taking all the potential losses of a moving vehicle, converting that into heat, and now we've got something that will heat that expanding gas indefinitely.
A couple of those things you mentioned just some of those sound similar to what David Yurt is talking about in his combined system. You've been talking to him, right?
Yeah, brilliant gentleman. Brilliant gentleman. Yeah, he's got a really smart idea of how to wrap all the losses of a system into something that really works well.
Mm-hmm. He actually, incidentally, gave a presentation. They roped him in at the last minute at the Extraordinary Technology Conference this last weekend. He gave a presentation on Saturday. It was just brilliant. He was like as far ahead of the audience as the audience is ahead of the mainstream. He was just blowing us away with talking about his wide bias and local angularity, or I can't remember the name.
Yeah, try to reduplicate that lecture. No,
I can't even remember the title, but it was fascinating talking about how the models of science are completely flawed, and by coming up with a new model, you can then come up with a new system of things that work because you can predict them and you build them and they work just as you predict them because your model is more accurate.
I agree with you 100%. He and I have sat down and had some strange and fun and wonderful conversations. What's really unique about his mindset is that he approaches this thing from a quantum mechanics standpoint. And the quantum mechanics standpoint is basically we don't know what happens below the level of an atom. And there are so many variations that come into play when you start dealing with things at the quanta level that you can't say that you can't get more efficiency out of systems just because we're dealing with heat and a little bit of friction and some, you know, and what we understand to be losses in systems that go back to an 1890s mindset. Okay, we've got to go beyond that and realize that there's a lot of energy potential below the level of the atom that if we could simply harness and shake it loose, there may potentially be 400 to 500 times more energy in a closed system than we thought was, you know, currently available. Just because we're shaking things in a lot smaller area. not that the science has ever been wrong on the second law of thermodynamics. It hasn't been. It works well for a closed system. But the way David's explained things to me, he's actually a consultant for my film, just so that you know, is that, you know, when you start shaking things up below the level of an atom, the rules go out the door. You can't say that something is not going to happen. You just can't, because there have been so many anomalies that have occurred in the last 100 years in physics that don't account for all these strange things that pop up when you start breaking atoms in half, that we've barely scratched the surface on energy technology. We can't even begin to say what you can't do yet.
Yeah, there was another brilliant presentation at the conference talking about how, and you would find this particularly interesting, because you're following electrolysis and turning water into a fuel efficiently. And they were basically saying that what's happening is that these electrolysis systems, and I think that was Murray King who was giving that presentation, that these systems are actually tapping zero-point energy. That on atomic level, as we do these different electrolysis modalities, as we hit these things with, you know, pulse DC and whatnot, it's actually creating on an atomic level a way to harness zero-point energy so that you're getting more energy out than what you put in.
I don't disagree with that at all. As a matter of fact, a big portion of this film has been for the last 5 years developing hydrogen on-demand type technologies. We actually haven't been developing anything, to be honest. What we've been doing is scouring research in libraries and laboratories that have been around since the 1860s to find out every method of electrolysis that's been used. And the standard model only allows for a certain amount of efficiency. And there are a lot of unstandard models where if you shake things with frequencies, you can liberate a lot of potential energy, not only in the hydrogen, but in the oxygen mixed in with it. And you can get, you know, efficiencies that are 400 to 500 times over what the standard model should be for electrolysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating, fascinating stuff. Let's get back to this ammonia system. One of the questions I want to get to is you're describing technology that was ubiquitous back in the, 100 years ago and was kind of shelved, and a whole, two, three generations grew up without knowing about this, and now, our great-great-grandparents, or great-grandparents in my case, would know about this if they were maybe, techies, whatnot, as we are now, studying this stuff. But, maybe even back then it was somewhat obscure, it was just starting to break loose. And now, you're chasing it. You know of somebody who you've got some, company relationships with companies that are developing this technology.
Sure.
Is there a version of this that's going to be made available to kind of the public in a nominally open source method so we can say, you know, here are the plans, go build one and put it on your house?
I'll say yes to that question. And I've got to, again, I'm tiptoeing a little bit here because we've got some confidentiality agreements concerning some of these technologies in the film, primarily because we're going to be revealing some things in the film that are not going to be commercially available. And so we don't want to jump on any proprietary methods of creating more power out of a system that has been known to exist since 1939. So what I've got to do is I've got to tell you that the technology that you would want for off-the-shelf, ready to plug in for your iPod, will probably not be released in this country first. But the open-source technology that you're requesting right now will be made available in the film.
Hmm.
You should be able to get a general concept of how to run a solar generator off of ammonia, a la 1939 technology, and we will be giving the plans away. And this is not our technology, mind you. Again, this is just technology that we've kiped and accumulated over between 1900 and 1947. And it's just a compilation of really brilliant guys that really knew what they were doing back in the early part of the century, that had no considerations about what you could or couldn't do, and they just built it. And they proved it many times, and there were patents that were given to these technologies and public demonstrations. And if you dug hard enough for the Library of Congress and a few other areas, you'd find photographs and film footage of these things coming out your ears. So what we've done is we've done the best compilation that we could for the film to reintroduce this technology as another possible method of reducing our dependency on foreign oil.
Mm. Well, conceivably, if this thing is using off-the-shelf components, you know, things that are already there in the marketplace, you know, generators, parabolic mirrors, and whatnot, you just go and put in orders in Sears catalog or go down to Walmart and buy one of these and go down to the auto parts store and get this widget and slap it together.
Yep.
And, you know, there may be some kits available for people who don't want to have to source everything. And then for people who don't want to do any work, they just wait for the thing to show up in the market.
That'll be for the rest of us.
But meanwhile, if I, you know, to kind of pull things together from what we've talked about in this interview, you're saying that with the release of your film, there will be a technology made available that, with a set of plans on a follow-up website that, you know, you can refer people to, they would then be able to pull these materials together and at a price point of about one-fifth of what they're paying for energy right now, not taking into consideration the long-term maintenance costs of having to keep buying fuel just to install this thing, that they're going to be at one-fifth the cost of what they're paying for electricity now, and they're not going to be reliant on the grid anymore. They're going to be able to have a unit that they can slap, you know, part of it's on the roof, part of it's in the garage, running their home.
That's the most important part of it, actually, is getting off the grid. We want to decentralize the system a little bit because, one, our grid can no longer handle the burden of the energy dependency that we have. We've extended our stay on this design. It was not a great design when they first popped it up in the early 1900s. And basically now you've got the president and you've got chiefs of staff saying, okay, well, the only way to resolve this is to install 100 new nuclear power plants and 120 new power stations across the country. Well, that's great, and it can't be done for another 100 years. And the idea of more nuclear power plants is just as abhorrent to me as it is with anybody who's got an ounce of brain cells left.
Oh, I have to just chime in really quick on that point. I've got a story on our website today, freeenergynews.com, about it's a propaganda piece. It's published at Fizorg today or yesterday. Actually, I think it was from the 24th of July, and he's basically saying that renewable energy is hard on the environment, and the solution we want to look for that has the smallest footprint is nuclear.
I love this. I love this PR campaign the nuclear guys have come up with. It's almost, you know, it's so, if they had kids running across fields with flowers during commercials, you know, I could totally see where they'd be going that direction with public relations. It's almost like the Camel cigarette ads.
Uh-huh.
That's what it reminds me of. It's this whole campaign of insidiously making you think that, you know, it's just a friendly product. It's been here forever. It's always been safe. Why worry about it? You know, your kids will be fine with it. It's just nuclear. You know, we never have problems with nuclear. You know, what the thing that makes nuclear affordable is the fact that they can dump the waste in a ditch and not have to worry about it for 250,000 years. You know,
yeah,
there are these little issues.
The next generation.
Yeah, you know, this is the campaign they've been running with Green Nuclear in Nature magazine, or not Nature magazine, but a lot of the environmental magazines and Popular Science, especially. Oh, I love it. I just love how these guys have just been laying in. And you could tell, I was watching the campaign lectures between the Republicans and Democrats. I noticed a couple of these guys slipped in green nuclear. We must use more green technologies, green nuclear, green atomic. It's like, oh, wow, the lobbyists really snuck in on that one. They're already in. They've already started burying it into the policies that they want more nuclear funding. And again, the thing that's never being addressed is the waste and also what you do with one of these plants when they have to be dismantled in 30 years is something that's never confronted in any of these finance issues. Plus,
right.
the big money, to be honest with you, and a nuclear power station isn't in running it. It's in the waste removal because there's only a couple guys in town that are allowed to pull that waste out, and that's built into your agreement when
mm-hmm.
you build one of these things.
Well, back to this ammonia thing and the idea of open sourcing and making it available so people who are handymen with these types of things, I would think that even just from this conversation we've had today, the guys who are really smart on this kind of stuff, oh, ding, 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 light bulbs come on. They go out and they buy it and they build it. They don't even need a set of plans.
I hope that's exactly what's happening right now, and I hope that the film does the same level of inspiration. We're not really trying to provide you with a finished, ready product that you can, you know, disconnect from the grid from. We're trying to inspire people to use their noggin a little bit and see that there have been so many alternatives available for the last 100 years that maybe a little bit of inspiration on a conversation that you and I are having will trigger 25 geniuses to knock together an affordable system that can be on the market by next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're there. I really do, because this conversation should point them in the right direction. If you started digging these things up, I bet you anything within the next 6 months, you're going to see a proliferation of closed-loop gas systems that have an exterior heat source that will be used as a source of power, waste remediation, motive generation for transportation. I mean, you name it. The sky's the limit for this stuff, because everything that a motor's been used for just required some creative force of heating or fueling. Well, this is that creative force of healing or fueling that we had, but we sort of disregarded in the early 1930s.
I would think the power plants would love this, because the stuff that the heat that they're throwing away right now into the environment, they can just grab that and generate X amount more energy. They don't have to build another power plant. They already have the energy source that they're presently throwing out the trash.
You got it right on the head. Actually, this whole idea of cogeneration or trigeneration, where you capture as many losses as you can on the way out of the factory. And like even, you know, Los Angeles, I live in beautiful Hollywood, California here. And, you know, you've got these coal-burning power plants in Burbank that if they were just to wrap one of these systems around the exhaust pipes of the heat coming out of those things, they could probably reduce their burden by 50%.
Wow. Well, Chris, this has been a fascinating conversation. You've whetted our appetite for your film. I already had my appetite whetted, but I'm sure those who are listening in who weren't aware of the movie you're pulling together, we wish you luck. Just really quick, I have to put in a chime for Stephen Greer. He gave a fascinating presentation yesterday about how we're going to go up against these oil interests who are not going to want to see this stuff go forward. We'll have to have a follow-up conversation, you and I, about that, because I think he's got a real winning proposition. We're going to be featuring his presentation here in the next few days on our website.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, so thanks for coming on the show. We've been talking to Chris Patton. He's a producer in Hollywood and a scientist and a agent extraordinaire. I could have spent the whole hour talking about Chris Patton.
Well, thanks, Domingo. It's been a pleasure being on your show.
All right. Take care.
Have fun.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net. and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at PESWiki.com. That's PESWiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.